From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn about some of the supplies and weaponry the Milwaukee Police Department is requesting for the DNC. Then a new study finds that more Americans are feeling more unhappy and isolated today than in nearly 50 years.
The very thing we need to cope with our stress is what we're lacking right now.
We learn about Black leaders organizing for communities and its efforts to engage voters.
So we try to really combine what are some of those really hyper-localized issues with kind of broader themes that we're hearing. And then are there openings and opportunities to advocate for some of the things that we want every year when it comes to the city budget?
Plus, Madison Children's Book author Pat Zietlow Miller talks about her new story, My Brother the Duck. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The Democratic National Convention is just around the corner. Although the event has been scaled back, the Milwaukee Police Department says it's still preparing for a large-scale event. While there will be fewer people attending the physical convention, it's unclear how many protesters will be coming to the area to take advantage of the national spotlight. The department's equipment order includes a wide array of things, from beef jerky and trail mix to pepper spray and a, quote, tactical gas delivery system. Jeremy Janine wrote about the order for Urban Milwaukee, and he joins me to talk about it. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a kind of strange story. As I think most of us know, the DNC was scheduled to happen earlier this month, but of course, things changed due to the pandemic. You know, they're now expecting a scaled back event, but in some ways, the police are still preparing for it, like everything's going to happen as planned. Can you give us a quick rundown of this situation that you covered in your article?
Sure. So the police originally were, and this is a security thing that's done in consultation with federal officials, there was a plan for 4,000 police officers to guard the DNC. Milwaukee does not have 4,000 police officers, so officers are going to come in from all over the country to help support the effort. And the question now is, well, if there's not as many people here, what do you need to secure? And there's obviously still Joe Biden's expected to be here. Other officials are expected to be here. And as Assistant Police Chief Michael Brunson said, it's unclear what kind of agitators might show up, what type of protesters, be they peaceful or maybe not peaceful. And so the police are kind of preparing as they were before. And with that comes a lot of contracts for a really wide-ranging amount of stuff, from everything from beef jerky and Gatorade to a battering ram that can deliver tear gas.
Yeah, some of the equipment that they're looking to get seems pretty intense. I think a lot of what has ended up garnering attention is the snack requests, in part because I think people look at that as being, you know, a little odd, a little silly. Can you walk us through some of those?
Sure. There's a request for 12,000 1.25-ounce servings of beef jerky, and it includes, and I included this in the article because I just found it a bit amusing, one of the requirements is, quote, a premium steak with natural smoke flavor added. They're also looking for 12,000 2-ounce packages of trail mix, which must include peanuts, M&Ms, raisins, almonds, or cashews. And a lot of that language comes from the city's bidding requirements, where they have to be very specific about what they're looking for.
Yeah, they are very specific. You look at it and you go, you know, beef jerky and trail mix, as someone with a dehydrator, these are things I just make at home.
Yeah, I can't join you in that club, but yes, it's just, you know, when you think about securing the DNC and the things you need, beef jerky, Gatorade, trail mix, those aren't things at the top of the list. At the same time, the police were preparing to have officers working 12-hour shifts stationed in areas across downtown and across the city. So it makes some sense that you would want those people to be fed and hydrated.
Very true. So a lot of what was inside of this request was for equipment. And it seems like they're allowed to keep some of this equipment. Can you explain that a bit, how the funding here works and what the money ends up going toward?
Sure. So there's the biggest thing, the $50 million, which has now been reduced to $40 million, but the biggest thing that money will go to is to pay salaries, both the Milwaukee police officers and officers coming from across the state and region to help secure the event. But then there's this list of stuff, which we talked about, is the food and the drinks they're going to have. But on top of that, there's things like vests with tactical pouches, handheld radios, combat trauma system medical bags. They're looking to rent 4,000-pound concrete barriers, the type of thing you'd see on a highway when they're rebuilding it, narrowing lanes. And with the federal contract, it's all reimbursable. But at the end of the event, anything that's not used, the Milwaukee Police Department can keep. And if we look at things like Gatorade, if the officers end up with cases of Gatorade, I don't think anyone's going to be upset. If they end up with things like a tear gas delivery system, I think people have the right to be concerned about that.
Well, and there is a lot of concern, I think, when you look at this list, because a lot of activists have been hoping to scale down the military-style equipment that police officers, police departments have access to. And a lot of the things that they're looking for seem to speak to that kind of heavy equipment that people are hoping to see less of. So what are some of the things the Milwaukee Police Department is trying to purchase?
Sure. They're looking to buy 1,000 pepper spray canisters, and there's a very specific brand given in the bidding request. We talked about the tactical gas delivery system, which is a device that gets mounted to one of the police armored vehicles. It goes on the front, and that's what can be a battering ram to get inside of buildings. And I don't think you'd see a lot of disagreement that, okay, in the case of an emergency during the event, the police should have that to be able to address any situation. I think the question then becomes, should the Milwaukee Police Department have that on a normal day? There's other things that are a bit less controversial, 40 handheld radios. Like, I don't think people are going to be upset that the police have radios.
No, most likely not. When I looked at this list, I did ask myself, is there any indication that these protesters, many of whom have, you know, filed for permits in order to protest during the DNC, is there any indication that they will be armed?
In the ones that file for permits, I'm going to guess not. They would be legally allowed to as long as they comply with Wisconsin law. But I think what the police department is concerned about, and the rationale, I'm sure, is that we could have the next president here as well as many of former presidents in attendance, is that people might show up that are not registered, that have firearms, and then what do we do?
Yeah. You know, you talked about the gas deployment system. I believe your article notes that while gas and smoke and gas mask equipment, they're no longer on the list, the department is still planning to purchase them. Is that right?
The department says it wanted them, and what that means is that there were bids open for that in June, and as part of a reappointment process for city officials after the April election, it came up that these bids were open, and the purchasing director was like, yes, I will review those, and within a couple hours of her hearing, the mayor had actually agreed to pull those things. Well, the police department came back, and we're talking about aerosol, projector, irritant, and gas mask equipment are the two items. The department said, yes, we still want those things to secure the DNC. They're also things that the department has purchased and discussed with the council, being able to purchase them without council approval. The Common Council has now moved to require all those things in the future to be purchased, to have to go through the council first.
Okay, so it seems like they'll still perhaps have access to gas and smoke?
It seems like they'll probably have access somehow. There's no explicit bids out there for those right now, but I can't imagine they're buying a tactical gas delivery system without actually having gas to put in it.
It would seem a little weird. So what are the next steps for this budget? I mean, we're actually coming up on the now planned convention pretty quickly here.
So since I published my article on July 13th, a couple of the bids have already closed, and they just kind of roll through by day. Not everything closes on the same day. Not everything is managed by the same purchaser at the city. And so those bids will be closing, and I assume very quickly they're moving with the vendors to procure those materials, because yeah, the DNC is quickly approaching. We're a month, a little bit less than a month away from it now.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for speaking with me, unpacking this situation a bit for our listeners. And thank you so much for your work.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
Jeremy Janine is the president and co-founder of Urban Milwaukee. Coming up next, we learn about a new study that looks at happiness. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Americans are more unhappy today than they have been for the past 50 years. That's according to a recent COVID response tracking study from the NORC at the University of Chicago. The survey was conducted in late May, before the death of George Floyd sparked international protests. And it tries to understand how Americans' beliefs, mental health, and outlook have shaped their attitudes during the coronavirus pandemic. So far, findings have shown less optimism about improving standards of living, less reporting of emotional and psychological stress post-outbreak, and half the participants say they feel isolated. To find out more, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Louise Hockley, a loneliness expert and senior research scientist at NORC.
This study covers a lot of areas, but do you think just publishing a study like this is a good place to start being frank with each other? You know, there are significant findings, but I suppose not very surprising considering everything that people are going through right now.
Yes, certainly. I think this is just a marker, the first step of trying to understand what's happening. And recall that this study is about the U.S. adult population as a whole. There are lots of differences among subgroups of the population and how they're experiencing this. Some people are actually coming away from this, probably feeling there's some positive things for them personally. Other people have had completely the opposite experience, are experiencing a lot of stress, maybe have had loss of family members to COVID. So it's worth exploring this further to understand where the vulnerabilities are particularly pronounced.
And on the note of vulnerabilities, this study found that Americans are less likely to report some types of emotional and psychological stress reactions following this COVID-19 outbreak. So why do you think that is? I mean, I think the pandemic has also help to start normalize conversations about stress and mental health, yet this study finds that people are less likely to report these things.
Yeah, well, less likely than, let's say, the 9/11 situation, the economic recession, the Great Recession of 2007 and 8. There are some differences in that what we had then was, well, in some cases, more of a discrete stressor, where this is going on and on. 9/11, the impact carried on, but the event was discrete. What we have now is an event that is ongoing. We can't retract from it. And I think what we had then that we don't have now is a means to decompress, to discuss, to cope with the stress we're feeling by using our social relationships. The very thing we need to cope with our stress is what we're lacking right now. So I think it's going to be easier for us to feel the buildup of stress because we don't have that social release that we've had in the past.
One thing this study points out is that about twice as many Americans report being lonely today, even compared to just 2018. Of course, not surprising given the lockdowns, which of course varies state to state, but do you think the lockdowns have exposed, in a way, any, I don't know if weaknesses is the right way to put it, but any faults in the way we construct our social lives in today's age that were so vastly disrupted?
Yeah. Certainly there's going to be variability in how lonely people feel under these circumstances. And that itself speaks to other ways that they manage their social lives that they can compensate, that somehow whatever they're experiencing now is allowing them a degree of satisfaction that prevents them from feeling lonely, and others don't have that, whether it's by circumstance or by temperament, or, you know, it's hard to say what might be contributing to it, but some people are going to have a harder time. And it will be important for us as a society to recognize that these are normal feelings for those who have them, and that we can work our way to a better understanding of how we can help people recover, help people find the social satisfaction they need. Part of it is recognizing in ourselves and in others that we are all prone to feeling that way under some circumstances. We're going to feel lonely, and that's normal. We think of loneliness as a biological motive. Why do people feel lonely? Well, it's adaptive. That's what gets you to get out into the world and make those social connections and strengthen your social relationships. That's what we need as humans. So it's normal to feel lonely. It's also normal to get, I want to say, hijacked by those lonely feelings. We talk about the brain being hijacked because then people start feeling like they're the victim and they don't have any control over how lonely they feel, when in fact there is control available to them. And we have to help people understand that these feelings are normal, but they can return to a socially connected life using some simple strategies. And that's a good thing. It's a good place to get there, where we can recognize that the feelings are normal and that solutions are available.
Yeah, so let's touch upon those strategies and those things that can help people gain that sense of control back.
Yeah, the primary thing that when we discuss this or study this topic is we talk about loneliness as consisting of a set of maladaptive social cognitions, meaning people get into a space where they think about themselves as being victims. They think and expect that they're going to get a negative response from other people, which makes them a little more careful because they fear being rejected or fear being unsatisfied by their interactions. So those very behaviors of being protective and putting up a little barrier essentially creates a barrier. Other people are going to be less likely to want to interact with them. And that cycles into a self-fulfilling prophecy where they become less and less able to feel like they have ownership and can control the nature of and the quality of that interaction. And this is where it's a typical kind of cognitive behavioral regimen that when we reviewed studies that had used that kind of approach to dealing with loneliness, that seemed to be the most effective. If you can alter people's expectations, their perceptions of their social environment, be more realistic about what they can get out of their relationships, they can gradually recover a sense of control and confidence and rebuild satisfying connections.
Did the levels of loneliness recorded in this recent study surprise you?
In a way, they did, and maybe not in the direction that you would expect. They're high, and you would expect them to increase because people are isolated. And yes, they're going to feel more isolated. They're going to feel more left out. They're going to feel like they're lacking companionship. On the other hand, everybody's really isolated. So why aren't we all just off the chart lonely? And that really gets at the distinction between objective isolation, like are you alone, versus feeling isolated, which you can feel even when you're surrounded by people, which is why this feeling of loneliness is an important bellwether for how you're interpreting, perceiving your relationships, and not for whether you have them or not.
I think that's an important distinction because a lot of people are living in different situations, whether home alone or with family, but the perception versus what your physical reality is.
Yeah. I still would say that there are risks associated with being completely isolated. I think there's reason to be concerned about people who live alone, particularly older adults who don't perhaps have technological expertise or access to Wi-Fi, you know, for all of the sophisticated means that younger people are using to connect with each other, it can be a very solitary feeling. And that's fine for a period of time. A lot of people live alone by choice. But at some point, that runs out, wears thin, and you need to have somebody.
Right. And your research focuses on loneliness in older adults. So just to set some groundwork here, how do you define older adults, and how has this period in history impacted your work? And have you been able to collect data on what the experiences of most older adults has been during this pandemic?
The data are being collected by a variety of organizations, and ours in turn is going to be launching surveys of our older adults. And by older, I mean we've got everybody from age 50 to 95 plus in our study. It's a nationally represented study. This is the National Social Life, Health, and Aging Project, run out of the University of Chicago and NORC, specifically the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. What we're tending to see in the data that are being released early is what I would call resilience, and what I'm hoping to study in our sample. Older adults have had a lot of life experiences, a lot of opportunities to experience stress, but also a lot of opportunity to experience coping, being able to mount a response, recover from, maybe even grow from difficult experiences in their lives. And I think if older adults truly have a bigger reservoir of those kinds of coping skills that improve their resilience, they may actually be better positioned than many would expect to handle the what we're calling social isolation, stay at home, social distancing. Part of it may be because they're afraid for their physical health and they want to stay isolated. But on an emotional level too, the capacity to handle that may be greater in that population than in younger adults.
This is obviously just the beginning, and all indicators show that I'm sure this will be happening for a much longer time as cases continue to rise. But what kind of issues do you think this study raises, and how do you think it could impact long-term studies in the future and indicate on any long-term societal changes on, I suppose, not just what people value, but the way we structure our lives?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a very interesting and important question. We start to get at that with some of the data we are collecting in this survey right now. And we're going back to people repeatedly. Like, we're the same people, we're polling them again this week, and we'll go again next month. So we'll see how their feelings are changing and how their lifestyles are changing over time. But there's a particularly interesting question that might shed some light on that, where we just ask an open-ended question. So what has happened in terms of the quality of your life? Like, has there anything good come of this? Just looking at that anecdotally, and you may have heard these stories as well, people are rediscovering the pleasure, the value of a family dinner around the table, you know, than they're dashing about and doing all kinds of things with the kids, or, you know, having your own schedule or whatever it may be. The joy of not commuting, of being able to have that much time for oneself that used to be devoted to creating high levels of stress. So yeah, there's lots of things that could reshape how we move forward. Less money needed, perhaps, because we're not computing, because we don't need a fancy work wardrobe, whatever it might be. So there are those pieces of it that could have lingering effects. And I think our study could, for some aspects of that, where we're measuring it, we can monitor whether that's actually happening.
What excites or intrigues you the most as a researcher studying this right now?
I'm particularly interested in the positive side. I'm keen to learn from those who have something to teach us. What are their secrets? They're managing, and maybe it's all about advantage. Maybe it's people who have lots of money and are well-connected and resourced in lots of ways. maybe that's it. But I have a suspicion there are going to be people who've had lifetimes of much more stress than I may have experienced, and yet have learned a way to get through this, and not only through it, but to rise to the occasion, be the people who are helping other people, be the people who are feeling happy about their opportunity to contribute to society. So yeah, those positive pieces intrigue me.
Well, Louise Hockley, I thank you so much for your time and for your work, and I'm sure we will learn much more.
Yes, I hope so. It's been a pleasure.
Louise Hockley is a loneliness expert and a senior research scientist for NORC at the University of Chicago, an objective, nonpartisan research institution. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find a link to their COVID response tracking study at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about Black leaders organizing for communities, also known as BLOC. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. As we inch closer to the November general election, community organizations are ramping up their outreach to potential voters. But for the Milwaukee-based group Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, also known as BLOC, these efforts are happening all year, every year. The organization was created to invigorate and inform Black voters in Milwaukee neighborhoods, and not just when there's a presidential election. The woman behind this organization, Angela Lang, was featured in an article in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. She joins me now to talk about her work. Angela, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, to start here, you know, BLOC is a relatively new organization. What inspired you to create it?
Yeah, it really was, in a sense, a response to the 2016 election. Very shortly after the results came in, we saw that turnout was down. It was down all across the state, but unfortunately, Black voters specifically were to blame for the outcome of the election and for the low voter turnout. And I thought that that was a misguided place to hold blame if anybody were to cast blame. And, you know, I think it's important for us to kind of reshift that and to think about blaming a whole community that wasn't engaged and a community that was essentially disenfranchised. And so what does it look like to not wait for a candidate or a party, but we would engage our community ourselves, and then we would also do it on a year-round basis. So we wouldn't wait for a candidate or an elected official. We would be making sure that we're talking to our community on a year-round basis, and then also making sure that they understand how politics works. What's the difference between a state senator and a U.S. senator? Why should our community care about the state Supreme Court? And so we wanted to make sure that people understood the roles and responsibilities of a political system, so people understood how they can get involved and understand the power and the agency that they have within themselves to participate in a process that, quite frankly, wasn't meant for us to participate in.
You know, you mentioned, of course, so much of what your work is community engagement. So for people who may not know, you know, much about BLOC just in general, can you describe what, you know, the day-to-day looks like in more ordinary times, I might add, when BLOC is doing its work? What does that work look like?
Yeah, so normally we would be in the office, so we're missing that factor right now. But largely, we would be out in the community knocking on doors. In such a big presidential year, we would make sure that we had a bunch of people making sure they were knocking on doors, talking about the election. We currently have 75 ambassadors. They are our field team, so normally they would be out knocking doors, talking about the election, talking about people's issues as well. So normally we would just make sure that the bulk of our work is done in the field. So our team would come in, they would check in, we would do role play. If there's any big news that came out about the candidates or about the election as a whole, we would talk about it. But before they even knock their first door, we put them through roughly 30 hours of training. So people understood how to have those more meaningful conversations on doors about the political process. And so we take leadership development and training incredibly seriously at our organization. And we kind of see that lens of leadership development as a way to really build long-term engagement and long-term political power here in Milwaukee. In addition, we have a fellowship program. And so our fellowship program, we just started that last week. And essentially what that is, it's a really intentional 10-week training program around basics of civics. So it's a little bit of what the ambassadors get, but a lot more intensive and spread out. But it's also the basics on how to register people to vote, basics in how to write a resume and making sure you know how to use Google Docs and Google Forms. We try to layer in some of those skills as well. So people are also prepared to, you know, engage in the future if they want to be able to continue to be an organizer, or they're saying, hey, I want to maybe be a data manager or a digital organizer or community organizer, having people develop those skills in addition to learning about civics. There's a lot of training and engagement going on. And then, you know, we also engage with elected officials. The closer it gets to an election, normally elected officials like to stop by, talk about the things that they're doing. And then if they were to go through our endorsement process, one of the requirements is a silent canvas, where they would shadow one of our organizers on the doors, and they're not allowed to talk, and they're not introduced as a candidate or as an elected official. So they're there purely just to listen, not listening to respond, but just to listen to the needs of the community.
What I think is so interesting about BLOC is that there is a big emphasis on that listening part of this equation, which it feels like so frequently it is a bit glossed over in different organizations. And one of the questions that I found particularly interesting, and you must find particularly interesting because you ask it so frequently, is what does it look like for Milwaukee's Black community to thrive? I'm so interested to know, what are some of the answers that you get to that question? Because it's so broad and so specific.
Yeah. You know, when we first started asking it, people were really skeptical. People weren't used to having people knock on their doors, if at all, but knock on their doors and asking them about their own thoughts and opinions. And so that's our way of really trying to understand what are the issues that people care about the most that are specific to that maybe neighborhood or that community. And we've heard everything from speed bumps and potholes to mass incarceration and healthcare and a lot right now around voting rights and voter suppression. So we've heard it all. You know, we hear a lot of things around speed bumps and potholes and stop signs. And we, you know, we tell folks, okay, well, that may not necessarily be a thriving community, but what I'm hearing is that you don't feel like your neighborhood is being invested in the same way that maybe Whitefish Bay or Shorewood is. And so we try to really combine what are some of those really hyper-localized issues with kind of broader themes that we're hearing. And then are there openings and opportunities to advocate for some of the things that we want every year when it comes to the city budget?
Yeah. So, of course, we're talking about more normal times, but we are not living in normal times. What has organizing looked like during this pandemic?
Organizing has definitely been interesting. We've all had to adapt and learn new things on the fly. So good thing that we were nimble enough and, you know, we're kind of structured in a way where we can make tweaks and edits as need be. But essentially on March 16th, we made the decision we were going to shut down our office. So we had about 48 hours to completely uproot our program, get tools and software that we were familiar with as individuals, but as an organization, we had never had. And then at the time, we had to train 50 people on those new pieces of software and programs. So it was a little bit of just a mad dash for about 48 hours and trying to get everybody all online virtually. So we're doing a lot of texting and phone banking. We're not able to be out in the field right now, but we want to make sure that we're still engaging people, specifically in these moments of the protests that are happening and the pandemic that's still happening. We want to make sure that we're touching base with people. So we're doing a mix of electoral conversations. We do have an election on August 11th. And, you know, people are really, I think, concerned and are curious about what these elections look like, given what happened on April 7th. And so we're doing the best that we can to get out the information, make sure people are requesting their ballot now, sooner rather than later. But we're also doing wellness checks, you know, where we're not talking about candidates and we're not talking about the election. We're saying, hey, my name is so-and-so from Block, just checking in. Do you need to be connected to resources? If so, which ones? Or, you know, when the protests first started happening, we were asking people, what policy changes do you want to see? If you were mayor for a day, what would you want to see and any policy changes that we could work on? And what's the best way for us to show up for the community? So we get a lot of feedback from the community that really guides our work. And then we want to make sure that we're being a resource to other folks if anybody needs anything as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that is coalescing at the same time. As you mentioned, of course, we talked about the pandemic, but there is a lot of social unrest. There is a lot of uncertainty as a result of the pandemic that isn't perhaps directly related to getting sick, but rather the offshoot of kind of our economy. I don't want to say collapsing, but having a lot of difficulties right now. When you're talking to people about what they need to thrive at this point, what are you hearing from people?
Yeah, I think there's some immediate things that people are looking for. There were times that we were texting around the election and people said, hey, great, thanks for the information. I'm trying to figure out how to pay rent, or I'm trying to figure out how to make my food last. So those were some of the things that we were hearing. I think some folks have settled into a groove, and I think other folks are still looking to continue to get those resources. I think people are questioning, are we going to get another $1,200 check? You know, are people going to be able to deal with the effects of evictions? And I think a lot of folks are really just trying to pay attention to how the federal government is responding in this moment, both in terms of the protest, but in terms of COVID, and how are we keeping people safe? We're getting a lot of questions, as I mentioned, about the election. Are there going to be more than 5 polling places? If I request an absentee ballot, am I going to get it in time? So we're hearing a wide range of things. A lot of it is election focused, but I also think that people are paying attention to things like the Fire and Police Commission a lot more because it's been in the news lately. People are paying attention to our police department. And I think people are doing whatever they can to make their voices heard too. So we've heard a lot in this moment. And it's something that we're trying to juggle and balance and tackle and figure out all the ways that we can be supportive too.
When we look back at the April election, which I know you were Block was, you know, lobbying to get it pushed back at least until the end of Safer at Home. Of course, we know that it happened. What have you learned as an organization, but you yourself, since the April election for the November election? As we're looking ahead to the November election, what are some of the things we can take away from what happened in April?
Yeah, I think a lot of us have spent a lot of time reflecting on the April 7th election and then also figuring out what does it mean for November. One of the takeaways, I think, is people were determined and found a way to make their voices heard, although there was a lot of people that were disenfranchised. You look at the numbers, and I think people were really upset that they felt that they were forced to vote in the middle of a pandemic. And for some reason, that was politicized, and it was somehow a partisan issue whether or not people should vote safely. And I think that really upset some folks. I think that really agitated some folks. But I also think subsequently it made people figure out, okay, what are my plans for November? What are my plans for August? My ballot didn't come in time for April. I'm going to request my ballot maybe months in advance. So I think there's that. I think also it's not lost on me that communities of color, which can ultimately sway an election and can definitely sway an election here in Wisconsin, communities of color and those voters are the same ones that are disproportionately impacted by the virus and are also the same ones in the streets marching, saying that our lives matter. And so we're seeing an intersection on all of these things about short-term frustrations, but I also think like long-term frustrations. And so I'm starting to kind of conceptualize this moment in two phases. You know, what does this moment initially between now and November and some of the immediate things that we need and the immediate wins, but also what is the long-term organizing after November? So all of the things that we're encountering, we never have to go through again. And we're making sure that we're advocating long-term for structures and issues to be worked on that are directly impacting our communities. And so, you know, on one hand, I really see this as a long game. I think there's a really big opening for folks to continue to organize and to get involved. You know, some of the things that are kind of common stance now are paid sick days. When 10 years ago, when we were fighting for it at the city, people thought that paid sick days was crazy. And now it's the common form. Same with, you know, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Everyone thought that was such a crazy idea. And then we're understanding how we value labor or how we don't, you know, how we value essential workers. All of a sudden, we didn't normally call grocery stockers heroes. We didn't always call teachers and healthcare workers heroes. And so we're really kind of, I think, reassessing as a society how we're valuing the work and the dignity of people. And then what are structures and mechanisms in place for the future too?
Yeah. As we look toward the 2020 election, there are so many people nationally, probably internationally, who are saying Wisconsin is the tipping point. Wisconsin is what's going to decide this election. As somebody who works in this, how do you see your work in the context of, you know, this bigger landscape?
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of pressure in this big year, to be honest. I've read so many articles and think pieces about Wisconsin being the state that could flip it. You know, we saw how the election went in 2016, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin were the three states that people didn't expect. And so I think there's a lot of attention played on those three states. And I think people also know that Black voters can also be the swing factor as well. And so Black kind of sits at that intersection. We're in Wisconsin and we target Black voters. And there's really no way to win a statewide election in Wisconsin without Black and Brown voters. And so it makes our work that much more, I think, intense and escalated. And there's a lot of pressure to increase turnout. You know, and we also see that there's some challenges and obstacles in the way. It can't just be a level playing field. We see issues like photo ID. We see how many people were impacted by photo ID. And then that same number of people that the current president won the state by. We're seeing all of these different intersections. So it's a lot. I think we definitely know our role in the larger ecosystem. And I think our folks really understand it too, or I try to remind them as much as possible how much power they have, and that a lot of people are really interested in our community and in our votes. And honestly, there's a certain level of power and there's a certain level of influence, and I think leverage that can be gained there, understanding just how important the Black vote is, specifically here in the Midwest.
Yeah. Well, Angela, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of your work.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Angela Lang is the executive director of the Milwaukee-based group Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, also known as BLOC. She was profiled in an article in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Coming up, we'll speak with author Pat Zietlow Miller about her new children's book, My Brother, the Duck. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. If you're a parent at home with your kids right now, chances are you've been reading a lot of books together. Madison Children's book author Pat Zietlow Miller has written many books, including the New York Times bestsellers Be Kind, The Quickest Kids in Clarksville, and Sophie's Squash. Her latest is called My Brother the Duck and follows a young scientist named Stella Wells who has a hypothesis she needs to solve. Is her brother a duck? Miller joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the book earlier this year.
So your latest book, My Brother the Duck, follows Stella Wells, a fledgling scientist. So what inspired the experiment in this book?
Well, I've always been fascinated by how kids can hear just part of a story and then kind of fill in the gaps on their own and come up with something that like just blatantly isn't true, but they believe it. For example, when my daughter was young, she went off to a summer day camp and she came home and she was very concerned. And she told me that the teacher said if she kept asking questions, he'd have to charge her extra. And she was very concerned that we were going to get a bill because of all the questions she was asking. So I told her that wasn't true and all was well. So for this story, the main character, Stella, overhears her parents saying something as a joke. She believes it. And then it kind of becomes a comedy of errors after that.
Right. And I love the lines. It says, a baby was bad enough. A duck was unacceptable. It's so serious.
Yeah, Stella takes things very seriously, but she's just a little misguided.
And of course, scientists can maybe sometimes be considered serious people, and Stella is taking her assignment very seriously for herself with gathering facts. But how do you first approach simmering down the scientific method for kids in a quick, concise, fun way like this picture book?
Well, I had to do a lot of research because it's been a while since I've taken a science class. I was an English and journalism major in college, and I mean, it's been a while. So I reviewed everything and said, okay, you know, you have a hypothesis and then you have to test it. And how might a kid approach testing a hypothesis? And then, you know, what's the evidence you gather and does it support your hypothesis or not? And so I ran it by a friend of mine who's a science teacher and said, did I kind of get the basics right? And then I tried to approach it from a kid angle. You know, Stella's taking her experiment very seriously, but you know, she's a kid, so she doesn't quite get everything right.
Right. And I also appreciated the fact that it's focused on girls getting excited about science and having it ingrained in them right away. Was this an important thing for you?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, I mean, girls in STEM careers, we really wanted to focus on having a girl scientist, you know, and in her using the process and trying to prove her points, whether she was right or wrong. And so, yeah, I really wanted to stress that in the book.
And some of your other books include Remarkably You, When You Are Brave, and Be Kind. And while this book and having a brother as a duck is a comical premise, it still follows a theme similar to the other books about being completely accepting. You know, at some point in this book, Stella is completely ready to be a big sister to a duck. So is that an underlying thing you want to always include in your stories?
Yeah, I think good picture books always have at the heart of them some sort of universal human emotion. So whether you're 4 or you're 94, you can be, oh, I felt that way. And so, yeah, even though this is a more humorous story than some of the other things I've written, I think it has that universal core of family and love and acceptance and loving people for who they are, even if they happen to be ducks.
You mentioned you have a daughter. Did you also grow up with siblings or raise multiple children that served as fun inspiration on how we view new babies that come into the picture?
Well, I have a sister and a brother, so I was one of three. And I have two daughters who are now, you know, out of the picture book stage. But I do spend a lot of time going back to their childhood because it's amazing what you can pull. And then I think as a writer, you have to kind of access your own inner child and say, how did I feel? How did I think? And if you can remember that, you know, you're in good shape to write a kid's story.
When it comes to the layout of this book, I'm thinking particularly about sentence structure and the way you're putting it out. So was this kind of a scientific experiment for you as well, or is this something you change according to your stories?
Picture books have certain rules that most picture books tend to follow. I mean, they tend to be short. They tend to have concise language, but, you know, each of my books, I approach a little differently. Like, you know, what's the personality of the book? What's the voice? And then how can I use my language to best affect that? Like this one is more funny and punny, and some of my other ones have been a little more lyrical. And so I try to get into the headspace of whatever I'm trying to write at that particular moment, which makes it fun.
With the illustrations of this, do you think it naturally reflected that? Because I know illustrations often come later, far after the story is done. And I'm a big fan of the way it's presented and the soft outlines, yet the strong colors. What kind of went into that?
Okay, well, the illustrator of the book is Daniel Wiseman, and he's from Knoxville, Tennessee, and he's amazing. It's the first time he and I have worked together. And I think when you get a good picture book illustrator like Daniel is, they add a whole nother level to what I wrote as the author. So I had what hopefully was humor in my text, but then he took that to a whole nother level with, like, you know, the titles on the stack of books that the dad is carrying and like Stella's facial expressions and making the baby kind of sort of look like a duck, while also obviously to anyone reading the book, it's a human baby. So yeah, Daniel made the story so much more fun, and I love the colors. Very bright, very cheery.
Yeah, the books you referenced, there's titles like Burping for Beginners, Life with No Sleep, and How to Be a Dad, Part 2.
And Daniel has two small boys, and he said he, you know, relied on his memories of, you know, what it was like having kids with a good set of lungs when he was like illustrating the book. So he drew from personal experience there.
Oh, and that adds so much more too on both of your perspectives.
Yeah.
And of course, right now, a lot of families are at home and parents are most likely struggling with trying to pick up the role of educator, you know, in addition to parenting. So especially right now, how would you like this book to serve families?
Well, I'm hoping it can just bring families together. I have so many friends who are trying to do their full-time work from home while also, you know, shepherd their kids through online school. And it's a lot. So, you know, I'm hoping that this book and other books can just, you know, be a moment where families take a break, sit down together, share a funny story, and reconnect without like it being homework or, you know, a chore, just something fun to remind everybody why they like each other.
Have you heard any feedback of people sharing this story in unique ways to work around social distancing?
Well, this, it's so new. The book just came out, so not yet. But I do know I'm planning on doing some live readings online. So hopefully people can watch and listen to the book online. And I know with other books that I have out, people have, libraries have done, you know, virtual story time with them. Families have done Zoom meetings where they all gather around and read the book. Take Your Child to Work Day, which is like a corporate event, I think is just this week. And I know several companies did online versions of my books. So it's neat to see people kind of still relying on literature, even in the age of social distancing.
Right. And, you know, it's still important to share books in whatever way we can, even though the experience might be a little different. You know, do you think much is lost, even if we're holding up a book on a Zoom lens to our family across the country, even if they don't have that book in front of them to share?
Well, I mean, I think books are always best, especially picture books, if you can have the kid on your lap and you're having that, you know, human touch along with the story. But when that's not possible, I think sharing a picture book any way that you can is amazing. And I've seen some really good online author and family presentations where they've done books online and it's been just delightful. Like everybody dresses up as the character or, you know, it's grandparents reading the bedtime story remotely before their grandchildren go to bed. It's pretty cool.
Well, I appreciate this book so much, and I'm sure many families will, and it'll brighten some people's reading times. So Pat Zietlow-Miller, thank you for taking a few minutes of your day to talk about it with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Pat Zietlow-Miller is a children's book author from Madison, Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in May, and her latest book is out now. It's called My Brother, the Duck. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.